You're about to hear Thought Leader Life with Mitchell Levy on the FIR Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Mitchell Levy, and welcome to episode 112 of Thought Leader Life. This is a fun month for me. I'm truly enjoying it. We've got Jacob Warwick, who is a copywriter, brand storyteller, obviously millennial. We're talking about millennial authenticity. And Jacob, I loved our last show. I'm absolutely looking forward to this one. Thanks so much for bringing on such a great group of people.
Yeah, well, I think this one was just as much you with Tim. We met at Social Tools Summit, and happy to have everyone on board. Learning a lot this time, and I'm broadcasting from a not so sunny California outside a Starbucks area, and we'll see what happens. This will be real authentic.
So, by the way, I kind of threw up a lob there, right? Because just so for those who are listening or watching, so Tim was somebody I just grabbed to be on, but I want to give my co-host the credit for everything. But it's really cool when somebody says absolutely immediately, hey, this wasn't me, this was you. And I think that's part of authenticity, and let's hear more about that. We've got Tim Sekou, who is the co-founder, CEO of Tint. You've got, 45,000 clients. You do some amazing things. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks. Thank you for giving me this opportunity and your time to share and learn some great insights with everybody here.
Hey, just to start, for those, few people in the world who don't know what Tint is, just a quick summary of what Tint is, and then we'll talk about you.
Absolutely. Real quickly, what we do is we're a software that we sell to marketers in organizations that want to display their social media content, whether that's their own content or their hashtag content, directly onto their websites, TV screens, projector walls at events, jumbotrons in game stadiums to further engage their audiences. So that's what we do.
Perfect. And so clearly you're a millennial.
Yes.
And you're in a position that is pretty good for the number of clients. Is it 45,000 or bigger? I mean, it's a big company you've got at the moment.
Yeah, we serve around 45,000 brands, and out of those, a percentage of them are paying. Just so everyone knows, we have a freemium model, so that's why we're able to achieve that sort of scale. But yes.
So your company. What's the average age typically of the company? How about yours? Oh, we may be frozen. It could be me.
I'm back.
Oh, okay. That's right. This is the way life is. We got Jacob outside, so hopefully we'll have something interesting like a lightning bolt or
we'll keep it. No. It's actually, it might start raining. I don't want to jinx it. This is a new laptop.
Okay.
But go ahead, Mitchell.
Oh, yeah. So what's the average age, again, of your organization?
Sure. Our average age out of the 35 people we have here is right around 27 years old.
So and looking at the pictures, there are some people who are, significantly older than you, or let's just say older than you are. How does it feel as a CEO, or how do you motivate your peers as well as those that are of different age than you? Uh-oh.
Sorry again. It keeps coming in and out. What was your
That's
question?
Right. Oh, how do you motivate those people which are, your peers as well as those that are older than you? Oh, we really are coming in and out.
Yeah. I heard you. I think you mentioned how are we motivating our employees?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So one of the best answers I have for that is our 6 culture value statements. And I think culture value statements can be completely overrated, but I think it can also be underrated if you practice it and execute it properly in your team. So ever since the beginning of our organization, when we first hired our first 2 employees, we went through a retreat outside the city and came up with these 6 culture value statements. And every day we try to practice that, and we'll call each other out when we don't practice that, And it starts with the leadership, making sure we are practicing that on a weekly basis and calling each other out and reflecting on how we're practicing those. But if we can align everybody on these, and this also goes through our interview process that we watch out for, we have a culture interview whenever we bring on new employees. If we can align everybody on that, then you have an opportunity to inspire these employees to achieve something greater than just their day-to-day, which is be able to live this like intangible concept. And that, I think, helps differentiate and helps motivate the employees in this company.
So hey, can you name the six? Do you mind?
Yeah. The first one is trust yourself and trust others. The second one is strive to be of value. The third one is stay humble and be tenacious. The fourth one is better yourself every day. The fifth one is seek to understand, then to be understood. And the sixth one is cultivate transparency both internally and externally.
So, Jacob, you're sitting there.
What we're talking about.
Yeah, you're sitting there. You got this big, big smile on your face. I mean, doesn't this all say authenticity?
Yeah, there's definitely a little bit of peace in there. But one thing I've been noticing as kind of a debate online, and I've been taking part in it a little bit. You mentioned that you do cultural interviews.
Yeah.
How important is culture when you're hiring someone? Say you have someone that has a great skill set but might not be culturally fit, particularly for a younger company. When you're looking for executive leadership or someone with 20 years of experience but doesn't quite fit that younger millennial culture, what's more important, culture or skill?
Yeah, great question. And I was always confused about that for the last 3 years that I've been operating this company. And it wasn't until maybe the beginning of this year or end of last year that I finally came up with a more clear answer. And the way to answer that is essentially what I call a double bottom line. You have your business bottom line, which is your value add to the business on a day-to-day basis. This is your role and your responsibility. But then you have your culture bottom line, which is like, how well are you able to work with others? How well are you to inspire others? And how do you act when there are no managers or leaders in this company? Let's say they're off for vacation. How do you act? And so the biggest confusion was like, well, there's some people that are accelerating in the business value add, but just are horrible in the culture value add. No one is able to work with them. And then there's the opposite, which is like some people are so fun and so great to work with, but their value add on a business day-to-day is just nothing there. So the way that I've identified it with our organization is that someone has to meet both of them. You have to be able to add great value to the company, and you have to be a great culture add to the company. If you're high on one and low on the other, it does not average each other out. And that's a firm sort of stance that we've taken. So to answer your question, if we found an executive that was so good on the business value add and just horrendous on being able to work with, we wouldn't pick them up. Even if it means like X million dollars in sales that are, you know, 99% guaranteed. It's just that that's the way that we've built this organization. We've actually not picked up someone who was very, very promising on paper and on the business side. And then we've also not picked up people who just are not great at culture and just like are all about, you know, sharky shark and just get the job done.
Oh, I'm absolutely with you on that one. It's very interesting, Don. I'm going to think about this. You've given me an aha moment there, Tim, because I would answer the question before you did is I wouldn't have put in the two components. It makes a whole lot more sense to do it that way. And if we really think about it, there may even be a third. I'll have to think about what the third would be.
Sure.
But I would absolutely say that, Jacob, is having sat on the board of a public company, one of the biggest things that board members look at is cultural fit in an acquisition, right? So if we're buying another company, what are we actually buying, right? Are we buying customers? Are we buying product? Are we buying people? And many times the people component were a big component of the actual acquisition because how they fill in the bench of what we already have today, right? And so I thought there was a very obvious answer, but Tim, that was real nice.
Thank you.
Well done.
I hope it was helpful and spur some more thoughts around that.
Yeah, I have one more part to that. So this again goes with authenticity. When you're doing those interviews, skill sets are something that's kind of bulleted on a piece of paper, read on a LinkedIn profile. Recruiters tend to get that, right? And there's tests for skills. You know, do you know HubSpot or not? Do you know how to do marketing or not? You can pretty much determine that quickly. Well, how do you get around in a cultural interview? Yeah. How can you tell when someone's faking it or being truly authentic?
Sure.
I know a lot of folks in their interviews, they come in and they're gung-ho and they're happy about an organization. 6 months later, it turns out it wasn't a good fit. Yeah. So what are ways that you do checks and balances there?
Sure. So a brief introduction is that we have a skill set interview as the first stage of the interview. Then we do a culture interview with me, and I've done all culture interviews up to this point. It's a good and bad thing because it can't scale if we keep growing the company, but it's a good thing because it's very consistent. And I'm still trying to figure out ways to scale that properly. And then the last round interview is a team interview, which is essentially five other people that this person will be working closely with that would test their skills a little bit, but mostly focus the last round interview around a culture gut check and sort of sanity check with what I've passed through. So in the culture interview, though, there are certain type of questions I consistently ask, and I always require either a video interview or an in-person face-to-face. I need a face-to-face because you can tell a lot of what someone is faking or truly genuinely meaning what they're trying to say by seeing their nonverbal communication. So some questions I'll ask is like, what are you looking for your next part of your career? You know, are you more motivated by an in and out model, which is like slow and healthy growth, versus a McDonald's model, which is like land grab and go after everything? And what inspires you? Like, one or the other is not bad. It's just it can tell a lot of like what inspires you and what motivates you and what kind of culture you'll fit really well in. I'll also ask like, what culture challenges have you faced in the previous company that you just do not want to see again? On the flip side, what sort of things worked out really well that you would love to see in your next part of your career? So those are just a few couple questions that I always ask and make sure that I get. And then the last thing I always have is before every interview with the culture side, I ask them to provide five things that they want to contribute to the organization. These five things can be a list, it could be a presentation, it could be a project, it could be whatever they want. Some people have Lego pieces to represent what they wanted to bring to the company. And the creativity around that, as well as the focus on a good balance between the business value add and the culture value add, will tell if someone is truly genuine in what they're trying to say or just trying to get the job. So those are just a couple examples that we've practiced that helped a lot.
And then what would be the biggest red flag for you in that interview?
Sure. I'd say that I have quickly cut off interviews or can quickly just tune off interviews if they – how do I say this? If – well, one, they didn't read our culture value statements or our blog around that. That's a big turnoff.
By the way, anyone listening or watching – before you get on the phone with anybody, it only takes you a minute or two. You know, if you're interviewing, man, spend at least 15 minutes, if not much more time. It's just so easy today. So
anyhow. Yeah, exactly. So not only just the blog, but like I'll specifically ask them like, hey, what culture value statement really resonates with you? So that's already assuming that they read it, and that's also assuming that they spent time to think over which one they prefer a lot. So that's one of the biggest things that I always ask in the beginning. And if they haven't or can't answer that, I'm instantly turned off by that because we really want people to come in for, you know, the culture side of things, assuming that they meet the business bottom line there.
So what would happen when you give the example of the in and out sort of slow growth versus McDonald's fast growth, and they say, sorry, I'm a vegetarian, never thought about it?
Well, if they never thought about it, then I'll probe into it a little bit more and say, like, if you had the choice to start your own company, which one resonates with you? Is it fast land grab growth, like hyper growth, or is it the healthy growth, which is business 101, make sure that you make more than you spend, And that's not saying that because you raise money that you're not that anymore, but it's like, where does your intention come from if you were to start your own company? Which path would you prefer to take? And I don't think there's a middle ground. I think it's one or the other. And one or the other isn't a bad thing at all. It's just, what do you prefer? And that'll insinuate the type of culture that makes sense to foster that.
Yeah, I was going to say, Jacob, the way I'd answer that is I actually have been in interviews where you say something along the lines where you use examples of two meat companies, and then the person goes so far astray on how they're a vegetarian and how they can't sit in a room with people who eat meat, you then know immediately, hey, sorry, this is not really a good fit for us, right? That's kind of what I was implying, is that sometimes – in the words you use and the metaphors you use, people will jump to a conclusion so quickly, and they're not open to really understanding the true meaning of what you're saying.
For me, I love direct answers, and trying to sort of skip around that really frustrates me because I have so many things going in my head already, or doing that. If you give me a direct answer and I know it, then it'll make my life that much easier, which is a lot of reasons why, like, my answer. And I think that does play a little bit into just being authentic, like being very honest and being very genuine and providing value in the most direct way possible versus trying to make it confusing or not valuable for your recipients.
So, you know, Tim, I often hear about, and you've blogged about this as well, millennials either work way too hard or don't work hard enough. Mm. And there's these both side of the equations. Obviously, it's hard to categorize any generation. What are your thoughts on that? And how do you sort of balance either side?
Well, I saw Jacob smile, so I'd love to hear his response before I share mine.
Hey, well, sometimes we say we work really hard, and the old-timey guys go, well, back in my day, it wasn't so easy. Or you can battle that kind of age gap like that. And sometimes we don't know what hard work is.
Yeah,
pretend that we do. So I think it's typically generalizations are pretty bad, but I've seen a little bit of both.
Do you feel like you fall into one of the categories right now that you self-identify?
I self-identify that sometimes I work really hard. I have a tendency to just – I'll put in 100-hour week, go, 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 and then just burn out. And then I'm just – don't even want to talk on social. I'm just gone. I'm like, I shouldn't be expected to do these things. All these other folks don't have to do thought leader life. These folks don't have to do things after work and, you know, not spend time with the family. And then you kind of get in that mentality, and that's no good. So I usually am only in that phase for about a day or two, and then I get over it and start working hard again.
That makes sense. So the way that I would think about it is, first, I think it depends on how you define success and how fast you're willing to try to achieve that in your own personal life, right? So, like, you want to be a millionaire by the age of 30. Obviously, you're going to push and grind and work in specific industries that will allow you to do that, if that's your one and only goal. For me, like, I've identified my sort of self-mission of in my life to, like, give more than I take, and that can mean a lot of things, but that doesn't mean I have to, like, burn out. And the other perspective I think about it is, like, in, let's say you're in a company or you're starting a company for those CEOs or founders out there, the way I see it is that startups is not a marathon and it's not a sprint. It's a marathon of sprints. So like Jacob mentioned, you're going to push in that, you're going to put in those 100 hours a week, and then the next few days you should just, like, release and let go and recharge, and that's it. Some people's sort of, like, sprints is longer than the others. Sometimes it could be 6-month periods sprints. It could be 3-month sprints. For me, something that I've practiced is sort of 6-month sprints, where every 6 months I'll push in and give everything I got. And then for 1 week or maybe 2 weeks, I'll leave the country and go relax somewhere, either by myself or other people in the community, and just recharge. And that's all it's for. And I don't even plan anything over there. I don't try to do anything. I just recharge there. So that, I'd say, is, like, another way to see it, where, you know, in a company or even in your job, if you're thinking long term here, to grow into something more meaningful, it's a marathon of sprints, and you'll have to recharge and get that water replenishing your body if you want to get to the finish line.
Dude, you are awesome. Really, I'm so enjoying this conversation. It's pretty amazing. So I do want to ask this because we've got somebody on our team who's actually writing an aha book on the millennial pet peeves.
Okay.
And so I'd like to have both of you guys sort of give your two cents, your thoughts on what you consider either your own personal or what you see in others, or even what you see, particularly from your perspective, Tim, if you have your investors come in and they go and they assume something because
right.
you're a millennial, right? So
right.
feel free to give whatever angle you like or all three.
Jacob, you want to go first?
Yeah, I need to be careful when we start talking about pet peeves because I've noticed I began following a fair amount of influencers or social folks on Facebook, and I just see hashtag rant all the time, and I'm really, really careful because you want to share your opinions on things, but you don't want to come off too negative.
Sure, sure.
Pet peeves of mine, and again, when I see a pet peeve in the industry, I want to blame other people, I really do, and as soon as I start doing it, I kind of have to turn the focus back on myself. I've noticed that a lot of job descriptions will want someone in their 20s that's active and willing to travel, but they need to have 10 years of experience and a college degree, and it's an underpaid position in the heart of the city and working for a startup at 80 hours a week. And you're like, are you kidding me right now? What do you want from me? We'll pay you $50,000 to be in the heart of San Francisco where it's $40,000 a year to live rent-wise.
Yeah.
But you're working for stock options and you're working for exposure. So this is it's a tremendous experience. We want 120 hours a week from you. You're young. You can do it. We also want all these skills, 4 to 5 years, which is kind of impossible because you just graduated last year, but I can go on a rant for that, but I think some of it's just really kind of fine-tuning what you're looking for when it comes to like a job search or something like what it is you actually expect from a millennial. If you want them to have a master's degree, then they're already going to be 26, 27 years old. You know, and I mean, obviously the millennial age is shifting, and I mean, that's just kind of where I was sitting at the time. But once you have a master's degree and 4 or 5 years experience, you're already, 32.
I can't say that I did that, but I can totally understand maybe different companies or different industries that are not as updated to but I can see why that has happened.
So Tim, how about yourself? So what are some pet peeves that you're thinking? What does that call to mind for you?
Yeah. So the first thing that came to my mind was just the sort of amount of like competition and, well, let's say unnecessary competition between millennials that, at least in my friend group or community that I've been a part of. And even in San Francisco, I think, which is kind of challenging and unfortunate, because I think everybody can win so long as they define what they want to win and partner up and find the right people in the community to help win that. What I've seen is like certain millennial CEOs that, tout of how much they've raised and how fast they're growing. And like in the end, like, for me, I ask, like, well, why are you sort of pushing that or sort of boasting about that? Is it because, you have something that you're trying to hide? There's really no reason to. I think all of us are facing the same challenges. All of us want to achieve the same thing. And maybe this is just my perspective and my point of view, but I think everybody can win, and we can all help each other achieve that. It doesn't have to be especially in different industries or different, even just different age groups in the millennial generation, doesn't mean that one person has to take it all and take all the glory and fame. If anything, it should be what can I do to help you? Because we can all win. So that's one frustration that I've seen in many of our, in my friend groups or community, of how much does one make? How much did one make already? How much is their bank account? It doesn't resonate with me at all.
Yeah. I've even seen a little bit of challenging with personal branding. I think a lot of millennials are very good at personal branding, and you need to be careful because when you're branding, you want everything to be seen in a good light and again, be authentic. And something I've been struggling with is I'll brand myself a certain way to position myself in the industry as a thought leader, but then again, how can you be a thought leader when you're so young and you don't have this real experience to make those claims? So a pet peeve of mine is that regardless of like your age or expertise, you can still be a thought leader on other folks that are in a similar, you know, position as yourself. I mean, you could be a thought leader amongst millennials. You don't have to be the end-all, be-all thought leader of marketing or of young CEOs even. It's really resonating with your peers. And So I'm having that disconnect and that pet peeve with I want to have a personal brand, but I also don't want to appear to like be a know-it-all or be an expert. I still want to have that authenticity, but that's definitely a challenge in the branding process.
I've had a recent experience that I can share real quickly off of that, which is for me, I also saw a big challenge of like people in this generation needing to seem perfect or seem like they're really good or can't have any flaws in them. And recently in December, relating to like personal branding, because this was under my name and my blog, I blogged about like mental health in Silicon Valley as a CEO.
Uh-oh. Hey, Tim, when you come back, you froze when you said I blog about mental health and then you cut out.
Yeah. Can you guys hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Cool. In December I blogged about mental health in Silicon Valley as a CEO. And the way, it was under my name and it was under my branding. The way I presented it was like, this is my experience. My hope out of all of this and this measure of success of this blog is going to be if this inspired you to do something. And I don't care about anything else. I don't need the fame or recognition of anything else. And I said that very clearly. And then at the end of it, I also wanted to prove and put my words where my mouth is by saying that I'm willing to like invest time and chat with you if anybody's sort of facing these challenges. So maybe the way I see it is like if you qualify it to a point where it's more authentic, like I'm just trying to add value and this is my experience and I'm not trying to say that I'm the best or I'm the best psychologist in the whole Silicon Valley because I had this experience, but more so this is my experience. I just want to share a story. If it resonates with you, if it inspires you, then that makes me super excited to hear.
Yeah, and I think that authenticity is what makes thought leaders in the first place. I don't think you're going to become a thought leader by what I've seen to be like the copy and paste approach, where they saw what was successful for someone else and they just automatically agree with everything they say or put a rant on it or things like that. I think that's a very good way to go about it and say, hey, this is my experience and this is what I've seen. And that kind of allows others in the community or whoever it is you're speaking to kind of relate or disagree.
Yep.
Well, I think for me, the definition of thought leader is the recognized expert in their space. So it's when your peers, whoever they are, go to you because of that. And Tim, I stumbled upon your blog and saw that. And I felt for you because it was your blog was truly written from the heart.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I really felt you. And I did see that call to action to others.
Right.
Who was interested. And I didn't get the impression that you now are considered, Dr. Know-it-all. But rather you're like, hey, listen, I had this problem. I think I'm going to do the following. I think this will work. I'm happy to talk to you about it if you want to talk about it. And I think it's that public – maybe part of this goes back to authenticity. It also goes back to the fact that you're comfortable living out loud that way.
Sure.
I thought that was the coolest part of that thing. And it caused me to want to help in however I could. So.
No, I'm very happy to hear that. And thank you for sharing. That makes me smile as well. Beyond that, I think the one thing that made it work and it really resonated with a lot of people, I got tons of emails and tweets afterwards, was the intention behind the blog post. So the intention of the blog post was not to be the best psychologist in mental health in Silicon Valley. Not at all. It was something that the intention was to talk about it because it was something that was not talked about enough. And I know that it's happening to a lot of other CEOs. And the intention was to say, it's okay to talk about it because there are other people feeling it as well. And it's okay to come out of that shell because it's a real problem. And if we don't address it enough, or at least just talk about it or be aware of it, other consequences may happen that we just do not want to happen.
So, this is sort of resonating with me pretty heavily. So I actually will share just a little quick story. I started writing and contributing content to MyFitnessPal and Under Armour. And there was no end goal there except to share a pretty authentic story about weight loss and how it worked for me using the mobile app, right? I had no intentions on selling something. However, when I write about marketing, my mindset's different, not because it's not something I do every day or because it's not authentic, but it's because I'm trying to teach someone, and it's typically not as authentic because I'm at the end of the day, you're trying to get conversions or you're trying to do something else.
I can see that.
So I think now that I can, I'm identifying with the story because I have a blog on MyFitnessPal where I have my shirt off before and after losing a bunch of weight. And I was like, I'm not perfect. So what? That's like the name of the article. And if I take a little bit of that mentality and I bring that to what I do with marketing, I think that, you know, everything will resonate a little bit deeper with the audience.
And I faced that same and I experienced that same challenge because in the company you need to make sure your conversions are making sense so that you can survive. The challenge is that this thought leadership strategy and practice is more of a long-term strategy, which plays onto authenticity because you're really betting on providing value and focusing on long-term there, where maybe sometimes a company cannot focus on long-term strategy just because they're potentially running out of money very quickly or very soon.
And I think I got an aha from that, Mitchell. You'll be happy. Thought leadership is a mix of when empathy meets authenticity.
I like that. I like that.
That's interesting.
That was as simple as I could put it. I'm sure there's a lot more depth that we can dive into there. I just was thinking that level of empathy for your audience and being your authentic self is really important for thought leadership. And at first I was thinking content, because content marketing is a little bit of thought leadership, and there's some other goals that we can do there. But in a nutshell, I see that empathy and authenticity as like the key to really great thought leadership and maybe even motivation and inspiring your readers to take action, so to speak.
Jacob, I absolutely love that. So I have on the thinkaha.com website, so thinkaha.com, I've got a tab that gives a 2x2 definition of thought leadership. And you guys are going to force me to go back to that tab and spend time looking at that 2x2 to see where the word empathy and authenticity may fit. So I'm going to think about that. I really appreciate that.
To riff off a little bit of that, Mitchell, you had sent me a question in the beginning of this conversation via email saying...
Oh, sugar. Oh, Tim, we heard where you stopped, you froze where it says you sent me a question and didn't hear anything else.
Yeah, you had sent me a question asking what does empathy mean in the millennial generation? Or sorry, what does authenticity mean in the millennial generation? And I had one word.
Right, and that's it for the show, guys. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. It's been a great opportunity. No, I'm just kidding. It was sort of like I got one answer. Just one answer. You saw that movie, and it's the best answer in the world. And then all of a sudden, it goes blank, and you don't hear anything else. So
I'm sorry about that. I had a list of a lot of words that I thought matched authenticity, but in the end, I narrowed it down to one, and the word was empathy. So right when Jacob started saying that, I started smiling because that was, if you had asked that question, that's how I would have responded, how
beautiful.
Empathy would have been the one word answer of what does authenticity mean in the millennial generation.
I promise I didn't have cliff notes. I had no idea. I didn't steal your ideas.
Not at all. I mean, you, that's amazing.
For those of you, one reason I think this show is really great is that we don't script it out. It's about as authentic as it can get.
Yeah.
I don't have time to think about what I'm gonna ask, or you know, we're just having a conversation here.
It's a great call.
Well, I loved it, and it's always shocking to me how quickly, when you're really enjoying yourself, how quickly 30 minutes goes. Tim, I'd love to is there a question, and you threw one in, which is good. Is there a question that we should have asked you that we didn't, or is there a way you'd like to summarize the conversation? And then, of course, how do people reach out to you? For instance, if they want to read your blog, how do they do that? So,
sure. I think what's most relevant that I sort of touched on but didn't go too much into, the question that I think people should ask themselves a lot more is what makes them truly happy in this, especially in the millennial generation where there's so much noise and options out there now. If you help define that and you help really set the expectations on what will make you happy in life, maybe this is the next 5 years, that will help you achieve that authenticity way easier because you have that goal in mind and that's what you're trying to optimize for, and everything else is noise and everything else can be ignored, and that's how you can really stay true to yourself and what makes you happy. So that's one thing I would suggest and would be relevant for the listeners to sort of ask themselves over and over. It's not going to be easy. It's definitely not an easy question. I still sometimes struggle with it. But coming with more clarity on that will help tune out the noise and help you understand and practice authenticity and empathy a lot more, I think.
I love it. And how, Tim, how do people reach out to you? How do they get to your blog or whatever is the appropriate way to contact you?
Absolutely. So love talking to people. So if you hear this and you want to talk more, please email me. My email is tim@tintup.com. So tintup.com. And then you can just look at our blog on tintup.com/blog. And you'll see a lot of my writings on there.
Oh, and you're spectacular. I love the way you frame things. And it was a pleasure to listen to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey, Jacob, what do you say? How would you like to wrap up?
I just want to wrap up and say Tim's a liar. when we talked to him earlier, he says, "Yeah, I'm pretty soft-spoken, so I won't be talking that much." And he has just been full of great insight, so I've been pleasantly surprised there. I thought we were going to have to
hopefully good stuff.
Oh, I thought we were going to have to ask you a bunch of questions, and you kind of led the conversation, and that was really appreciated. Made it pretty easy for me, that's for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, for wrapping up, I'm gonna try to fine tune that aha moment that I had a little bit earlier. And as far as reaching me, it's just thinkwarwick.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn or Google my name, and I'll get back to you. I answer everything that's genuine and authentic. If you send me a spam email, it's not. I actually respond to spam emails sometimes just so I can provide some feedback. As a marketer, I actually enjoy getting that feedback sometimes. I'll respond to like automated emails and say, "Hey, you know, if you change your automation a little bit and maybe, you know, focus more on what I was interested in, you'd get a better response rate."
That's a good idea. I like that.
I like it too. And so it's Jacob, JACOB.Warwick. Actually, Jacob Warwick, WRWICK.com. And by the way, Jacob, my wife asked if you were related to the Warwick Castle family.
I've been there, and I sarcastically tell people to get out of my home, but it doesn't fly over so well in the UK.
For me, I think, and you made me think about something, Tim, when you were talking. I'm not convinced I was truly my authentic self till I started working for myself. So I was taught when I grew up that the boss was always right and that your answer had to be the answer that the boss wanted to hear. And I don't think that's what I see inside companies today. That doesn't seem to be like how you run your company. It's certainly not how I run mine. But when I was working for corporations, I always thought about the answer that the boss wanted. And it was so enriching for me in 1997 when I started working for myself that all of a sudden the boss asked me a question, the person who hired me, and I gave him a true answer, and I didn't care if they liked the answer or not because it was my authentic answer. And, you know, when I go and do consulting, I go out of my way to have people fire me as quickly as possible because it means I did a good job, right? I was successful as a strategic consultant. I put the tools in place, and then they fire me, so I go away. And I think that change of attitude is important, and it was important for me, but I see that the way companies are run today. So anyhow, I just thought I'd share that. It's another way to think about you do the right thing for you, and that's the important thing. And if it's aligned properly with both the culture and the business goals, as you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, Tim, if it's aligned culturally, then the important thing for you also creates the important thing for everyone else. So, anyhow, that's my two cents.
You have a client retention problem, Mitchell. That's all I heard. I can't retain my clients.
No. I love being fired because it doesn't mean I'm fired from the company. I'm fired from this one job. It doesn't mean I don't pick up another one. So,
well, the best feeling is firing a client that isn't aligned, and meaning that you're not going to work because you need the money or you're not going to work to take their money. You're working because it's mutually beneficial to each party. That I feel like that's a really, really good feeling. But you don't always have the luxury have in your first few months or years in business. Sometimes when you're consulting, you got to figure out what works and what doesn't work to find where your real authentic audience is.
That's where a couple pieces of gray hair come in. Anyhow, hey, check us out at thoughtleaderlife.com. Check me out either at LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. I too will answer most authentic pieces. And I Jacob, you got me thinking. I'll give you one last thought. I got this call today from some telemarketer. I get so many of these. I think we all do. It started off with heavy breathing, right? So they didn't think that it didn't happen yet. And then it was an Indian telemarketer, and the connection was so bad that I could only get the phone number and I couldn't get anything else. And it was I heard something like, you absolutely need us and we can help you. But it was, I couldn't understand a word. So I wanted to I think I have to figure out how to take that recording and put it online and say, how would you like your people to making these phone calls? Starting with the heavy breathing. Oh my God, it was crazy.
That's hilarious.
All right. Hey, well, Tim, thanks again. You were fantastic. Jacob, thanks again for the month. I'm looking forward to the rest of our guests. For those of us that are watching or listening, I really appreciate you joining us. Feel free to reach out with any comments, questions anytime, and we'll see you at the next episode of Thought Leader Live. Take care, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye now. Cheers.
You've been listening to FIR Presents Thought Leader Life with Mitchell Levy, brought to you in association with Lawrence Reagan Communications, serving communicators worldwide for more than 35 years. More information at www.reagan.com. In each episode, Mitchell interviews a thought leader or someone involved in thought leadership and shares best practices to tease out how to become an effective thought leader. Thought Leadership with Mitchell Levy is part of the FIR Podcast Network, a series of business podcasts founded by Neville Hobson and Shel Holtz. The anchor podcast in the network is the Hobson and Holtz Report, a weekly show presented since January 2005. For information about FIR, to see show notes for the podcasts, and to subscribe, visit www.forimmediatereleasebiz. You can also subscribe via iTunes and other podcast directories. We welcome your comments about Thought Leadership with Mitchell Levy. Join the conversation in the FIR community on Google+. Look for the FIR podcast community or email us at FIRcomments@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.